everybody. Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. My name is Peter Pinkosov of the Real Vision Exchange. I am lucky enough to be joined by my two, lucky enough to call them friends here, Weston Nakamura, who is also a Real Vision employee here. He's a Real Vision Exchange superstar, host of a new show on his YouTube channel as well. And then I'm joined by Samuel Rhines, who is a former hedge fund trader, current economist. Guys, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us. Weston, I think you don't need any intro just yet, but I'm going to give Samuel the mic here just to give himself a five-minute intro about kind of who he is. But before we do that, let me just talk about what we're going to talk about today. First on the agenda, the Senate passed $1 trillion infrastructure bill. We're going to talk a little bit about global rates, what that means. The Aussie two-year absolutely exploded. And we're going to talk about Elon Musk, how he's planning to sell off 10% of his stock because of an unrealized gains tax. Samuel, do you want to give a quick intro about yourself?
Sure. I'm Samuel Rhines, down in Houston, Texas. Spent the first part of my career working in hedge funds, long-short technology, general global macro, a little bit of long only, and then moved to being a global macro economist in investment strategy with a large private wealth manager, and moving on to bigger and better things to be announced later this year. So fun and exciting times. You can find me at Samuel Rhines on Twitter.
Excellent. And Samuel, any general thoughts? $1 trillion infrastructure passed. Some people say it's a drop in the bucket. Some people say it's a very big deal. What are your thoughts here?
Yeah, I mean, it's a drop in the bucket. It's a, you know, call it $27 trillion economy. You're going to spend $1 trillion over the better part of a decade. Doesn't matter that much. I mean, yeah, it's a big $1 trillion. Sounds like a big number. Really isn't. Whatever kind of deal.
Yeah.
It will be somewhat of a mover for some equities, particularly things that are, call it, closely associated with infrastructure, bridges, roads, that type of deal. But generally, we need those things. The infrastructure in the U.S. is kind of crap. So we do need to upgrade those. We should probably, you know, now that we know, spend a little more money on ports, maybe reallocate some of those dollars over there. So, you know, it's a big deal when it comes to maybe getting our infrastructure a little bit better. It's a very small deal when it comes to, call it, quote unquote, juicing the economy moving forward.
Weston, off the top of your head, what are you thinking trade-wise on an infrastructure deal? What are you looking at?
Maybe I'm just too stupid, but there is no infrastructure trade because been priced in for how long at this point? Since before, you know, when since people were looking at polls between Biden versus Trump, and all it kept doing was just getting whittled down and kind of like still hanging in there. I'll put it this way: if the infrastructure bill didn't go through, with you know Democrats running both houses of Congress, as well as, you know, out of the Oval. And if that fell through, then there's a trade. Then there's many trades to unwind. But for now, I think it's just largely priced in. You got a popping Caterpillar and all that. But I don't really see anything. Like you said, too, drop in the bucket. I thought maybe something on the rate side as well, which we can get into later, but really nothing there either. So this is really just as business as usual as it is. It's kind of incredible when you're spending into the trillions, and that's just kind of expected.
Yeah, and it's funny because the market cap of, I haven't checked it, but I'm guessing the increase in Tesla probably matches the contribution to the S&P in terms of nominal dollars of how much we just went up. So, it does feel a little bit like a drop in the bucket, especially now. Samuel, I wanted to ask you because Weston just brought up Caterpillar, maybe some industrial trades. I think copper is a pretty close tie to the industrial trade as well. Do you have any thoughts on maybe not broad commodities, but specifically on the copper side? How much do you think that might be driven, the price surges, et cetera, might be driven by something like a infrastructure bill?
Almost none. I mean, there may be a knee-jerk reaction, very, very short term. It's maybe a very fast trade there, but in the long run, nothing really. What's far more interesting on the copper front is what's going on in China, whether or not they're re-accelerating or decelerating. their real estate and infrastructure investment. And we, you know, have a pretty good feeling that that's not going to happen in the near term, given the headlines we've seen out of Evergrande et al. On the real estate front. So I don't think there's much of a trade in copper or the broad commodity complex based on a $1 trillion U.S. infrastructure bill.
Sounds good. Well, I think the consensus is hard to find a good trade. So let's just move on from that one. Let's move on to global rates. Before we move on to that one, the key narrative around rates is inflation. Inflation is a very big contributor to where prices on bonds move. And on the essential tier today, we had Murray Stahl come on and talk a little bit about inflation, what it means for fixed income, and especially in the energy space, what divestment in that space means right now. So check it out. This is on the essential tier.
Inflation, I think it's more than just money supply. There are many factors structurally that are leading us to inflation. So I really believe we've hit a point of no return. And I think we're going to have a lot of inflation. Oil is more than just inflation. Obviously, it is inflation. But the problem is for at least 12 years, maybe more, the world has not properly invested in the infrastructure to maintain hydrocarbon production. Mm. And I don't think most people realize how enormous infrastructural requirements really are. Those expenditures are in the hundreds of billions of dollars globally per year. And we have a parallel divestment movement. So believe it or not, there are literally thousands of institutions that have pledged never to buy a hydrocarbon producing company again, never to finance one. And what they have left, they intend to sell. So the S&P 500 is now roughly, I might be a little off, 2.5% weighted in energy. So it's become a contrarian investment. And yet, I don't know how we can run society without it.
So there you have it. That was on the essential tier. Murray Stahl joining us to talk a little bit about inflation and divestment in the energy space. Now, Samuel, you being down in Houston, energy divestment is obviously probably one of the biggest things to think about 10, 20, 30 years out in your municipality. What are your general thoughts there? And it's specifically how it might tie to inflation.
Yeah, it's interesting. So you're likely to, you know, and we've seen significant investment across the majors in the U.S. and globally. But what we haven't seen is any major divestment among the independents or the call them private, large private oil companies. I think that's the transition that some people are probably missing on the margins, is that when you're divesting, you're selling to somebody. And that somebody is really interested in making a profit and really interested in, call it extracting oil, natural gas, whatever it might be. So while it gets a lot of headlines on the divestment front, what I'm paying very close attention to is what the smaller independents are doing. You've seen the rig count tick up significantly over the last month or so. I would suspect that's going to continue with these prices in what the private guys are doing. There is some capital that's beginning to trickle back in there on the investor front. If you continue to have some significant returns out of traditional oil and gas, it's going to be difficult for people to, quote unquote, avoid those going forward. So I think it is going to be a little bit of a, I would call it, it adds volatility to inflation. Significant volatility, because you don't have the immediate reaction to prices that you've typically had from the oil and gas patch over time.
Interesting. Weston, any thoughts?
I can't stand up against an actual expert, so no, I can't try there.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast, called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, Homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, I think that, you know, maybe the outperformance might even, for the first time in a long while, I guess, might be in some of those smaller cap, the kind of energy companies that don't have huge boards, that don't have ESG kind of standards being shoved down their throats at the moment and try to divest as much assets. They're actually on the opposite side, taking on more leverage at higher prices, actually doing that investment. So it's an interesting proposition. Let's move on to rates. I mean, Aussie 2-year caused absolute havoc. BOE caused absolute havoc. I think a lot of, you know, hedge funds, trading pods, et cetera, big shops have had big, you know, risk put aside, some people shut down, whatever. There's just a lot of volatility on that space. For those who are unfamiliar, Weston, can you tell the story about what happened on the Aussie 2-year, maybe, or the BOE as well, just to get people caught up?
Yeah, sure. So this is something that, for those who, you know, maybe haven't realized, I've been doing some videos on the Real Vision YouTube channel. The last one that I did was just basically warning about not to put too much emphasis on the FOMC from last week, going into last week, and more so that the banks of, you know, the central banks of consequence going into last week were the RBA, the Reserve Bank of Australia, and the Bank of England. The RBA at the front end mostly, and the BOE at the long end, but obviously, you know, for both as well. But especially at the front end of the curve. Yeah, so Aussie 2-year or 3-year rates were it was a historic move the week before. So Australia, the RBA has had yield curve control in place. Now, they were trying to essentially tame their rates, but they kind of threw in the towel and they didn't fight back when, April 2024 issuance had just blown through their level. But back in February of this year, this is the first time they actually had like an actual fight with the bond market. And as somebody who's been watching Bank of Japan, you know, do yield curve control, you know, just step in, bid for unlimited until, you know, yields calm down. So the RBA was kind of struggling in February to control their yield. And that was like a Friday, and it looked like they kind of threw in the towel. Then on Monday, RBA comes in, takes a sledgehammer down, and asserts themselves into the bond market. So this time, I thought that going into RBA on Tuesday, last Tuesday, I thought that they were going to come in and just, you know, put the, you know, Philip Lowe's going to come down, put his boot down on the ground and say, you know, we are, you know, Australia, we are a serious economy or a major, you know, integral to the global economy. We are, the Australian dollar is a powerful currency. And, you know, you don't mess around with the Commonwealth of Australia and smack rates down. But that's not what he did. They gave up on yield curve control. And this was not something that was planned or, you know, discussed beforehand. This was clearly the markets that had pushed them into that position, and they even said so. They said that, you know, this is we are not guided by markets, but we more or less are. That's not verbatim. Then on the other side, you have Bank of England, who essentially, for all intents and purposes, they jawboned in a rate hike, and they did not deliver on that. And that just shocked markets, and you just saw rates just plummet. And
why is that? Was that because everybody is waiting for the Fed to do something first? I just want to give Samuel a chance to put. Thank you, Weston. I want to give Samuel a chance to chime in though on this one. Samuel, what do you think? Was it because BOE was waiting for the Fed to kind of do something first? Was that why?
I think it's a little bit of the BOE wanted to inject some uncertainty into monetary policy, right? They wanted to begin to have some ability to raise rates in the future. And they went way overboard with their quote unquote forward guidance, right? Forward guidance is supposed to be something that's a useful tool, not something that's a market disruptive tool. And they just brought it way too far. They overshot. They were never going to raise rates at that meeting, right? That was going to be a problem. I mean, it was a 7-2 vote. It wasn't even like there was a real argument there. There were only two people that were like, yeah, we should probably be raising rates now. So I would say they want the Fed to raise rates first, or at least be a little more hawkish and have that tapering going before they raise rates. But there's no way they're waiting for the Fed to raise rates in late 22, early 23. According to Clarita this morning, there's no way they're waiting that long. They just want a little more hawkishness out there for, you know, in the global central bank market. So that they don't call it, you know, push their currency too far and absolutely crush inflation expectations, et cetera, right? They want to take it a little bit slower. And the market had just pushed so far ahead with it that there was no way that the BOE could do anything other than be slightly or very dovish as they were into that meeting.
Interesting. And you mentioned the Clarita comments. Do you think those have any materiality in the medium term?
Clarita has had three speeches. He said the exact same thing in three straight speeches, which is, you know, by late 2022, we should have a labor force participation rate, and he demographically adjusts it, whatever he means by that. I know what he means by that, but whatever metric they're using for that. And the employment to population ratio should be back to what would be consistent with full employment. There's a lot of what ifs in there, but you know, he's basically guiding that late 2022 is kind of the stake in the ground for the Fed at this point.
Now, all of these interest rate events, I think, have manifested themselves into some really, really interesting price action into U.S. Treasuries. I think partially because of what we just talked about, a lot of people are looking for what the Fed or ECB might even do, and we've been seeing the interest rate curve go from a complete steepener last week. Today, we flattened out completely, which creates a lot of interesting opportunities. Samuel, any general views on the U.S. Treasury market in the medium term?
Oof. In the medium term?
Let's say 5 days out.
5 days.
That's the medium term.
That's an interesting medium term. 5 days out.
That's the macro traders special, the medium term.
I think the curve is tough to trade at this point, not, you know, particularly on a 5 day. I think on a, you know, intraday and, you know, 1 or 2 day basis, it's really interesting. But the problem right now is that you have the confluence of two things: unwinding a lot of trades that everyone was caught in, and there's a lot of noise hitting markets with that, and the hawkish-ish language coming out of global central banks, which is we're going to quote unquote kill inflation. That's largely on the supply side. We're going to be in front of this, et cetera, slowing economies, blah, 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 a little bit of COVID thrown in there. So, you know, through the noise, it's probably a flattener. But, you know, you're going to have days where the flatteners get ripped off sides.
Yeah. Preston, any thoughts on U.S. Treasuries before we merge into the Elon and crypto space?
Basically, in going into the October end of September FOMC and subsequent Bank of England monetary policy, you had that meeting FOMC. You had no change in markets from right before 60 seconds before the policy was announced. The policy was announced at 2 p.m. and then at market close, it was literally a one point difference in SPX. Rates were flat. VIX was 21, ended at 21, all of that. Bank of England comes in less than, you know, like 18 hours later or whatever, talking very hawkishly about this past meeting. And they send yields, global yields, you know, surging throughout October. And then when they come in, they essentially had for the, you know, UK 10-year gilt side, at least, they had essentially brought that back down to its pre, you know, October surge levels. So if indeed the US Treasury, like from the 10-year tenor and on, if those are being driven by largely from the UK gilt market and the Bank of England, because everyone knows more or less what the Fed is going to do and that's kind of priced in, they're not going to shock anyone like the Bank of England is. If that's the case, UK gilt yields are basically back to around those levels, but the U.S. Treasury yield does have a lot more to fall. Now, I don't think that they are going to be moving tick for tick, but if they do sort of just have to reset back to those levels of unchanged from September FOMC. I mean, you're looking at a 1.35 on the 10-year, somewhere around there. So, but it largely is to those, like, just a whole bunch of macro hedge funds getting blown up, you know, over the past, you know, and I don't think that that's an unwind that was aggressive, that was forced. But just because the forced ones are done does not mean that the ones that are not forced but still want to be unwound are done either.
Sure.
They're taking their time. But year's coming to an end. Bonus season's almost here. So they'll probably be getting on that pretty quickly. So I think that you'll probably see more sort of disconnected moves and more rate volatility.
Makes a lot of sense.
In the 5-day medium term.
Thank you very much for the clarification on the time frame. Let's move on to Elon Musk. Guys, so he went on Twitter, complained about how the capital gains tax for unrealized gains is, like, you know, not fair or something. So he's like, so he's saying I should sell 10% of my Tesla stock because of it. Now, when I read that, I think, wow, this is such a good excuse for somebody who's just looking at a paper gain of $1 trillion. They're talking about taxing unrealized gains, and he says, oh, okay, I should sell, and I'll do a Twitter poll to, you know, basically justify it. I'll let anybody jump in on this one. Samuel, what do you think? What's going on with this tweet? Do you think he's actually bluffing, or do you think it's a chance for him to actually sell some stock here?
I mean, if I were him, I would take it as a chance to sell some stock, right? He does have a tax bill coming due next year, which is going to be, you know, non-trivial. It also gives him some liquidity. I don't think it's a bad move, and it is somewhat of a hedge against, you know, being a forced seller if there is some sort of unrealized wealth tax, which I don't think there will be anytime soon in the U.S.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
Nah, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
At these prices, though, Weston, maybe you can jump in on this one after. Doesn't it just make absolute sense for Tesla just to do a raise, like hard raise right now, and they'll be cash loaded for the next, 3-4 years? Sam, go ahead, jump in.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense if you think they can sell a significant chunk of stock at that valuation, right? I would think that you'd probably get, a haircut, a significant haircut on any sort of significant capital raise out of there. And, you know, how much equity are they going to raise? 10 billion, 20 billion? That's going to be, kind of whatever.
That's a whole new battery factory, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, it's a whole new battery factory, but financing the battery factory, isn't that difficult, right? I mean, it's very, very cheap to go out and, use your quote unquote balance sheet to do that. And it's very, it's not expensive, but it will cost, the equity holders quite a bit to go out and raise 10 to 20 billion.
Funding secured.
Weston, yes. Weston, what are you thinking for,
for Tesla? All right. So if Elon Musk wants to, do a clever little, out in the plain open IRS, inviting the IRS to look through his tweets. fine. That's not really that material. If they do an equity raise, what scares me about that, something like that, or even suggesting something like that, is that the markets have been, as of late, have been so driven by options, like options activity, especially on Tesla. OCC data from just last week, we saw last week as the second highest on record for, you know, options trading volume, the first being, you know, meme week from the end of January. And, you know, those are very fragile markets to just be balancing on, you know, some dealer's gamma exposure. That's what the entire, you know, that's what the entire S&P 500 is basically relying on. And so, and if the poster boy of that is Tesla, and you have just a string of, let's say, just limit orders and, you know, gamma expiries that just get hit, and, you know, these like flips that happen, it, you know, Tesla can really snowball the rest of the global equity market, for that matter. You know, just one stock and one like horrible vol execution. So it's really fragile. And a news headline like that, I mean, it could just be the algos that do it. It doesn't even matter what the you know, initial sort of spark is that gets that going. But I think that markets trend largely higher because everyone is taking, you know, not everyone, but people are starting to take like short positions on single stocks and long the index. And so that's why you're seeing this sort of slow drift up in SPX, slow drift down in VIX and all that. But it's being hinged on this powder keg of options, like, you know, outstanding, that Tesla itself could be blown up or can blow up the rest of them. And so I think it's really fragile.
So this reminds me, by the way, completely of January 2018. I don't know if you guys remember, everybody was shorting the XIV or buying the XIV every single day. We had literally the exact same setup in the markets where it just like went up every single day. And then it was just one event where XIV basically couldn't take that selling, where you had that volatility event. Very similar, where we're derivative of another thing.
Yeah. And to that point that was made, I think it's really interesting that Elon didn't throw out the idea of, you know, putting $50 billion in debt on Tesla's balance sheet, using half of that for a special one-time dividend, and then using the $25 billion left on the balance sheet to find, you know, pay it in over the next 10 to 15 years. I mean, that's a much cheaper way to do it, and, you know, doesn't blow up the stock either.
Let's move on to some questions. We got a few minutes left. Andrew M. from the exchange asks, hey, Weston, what are you monitoring for this BTC and Ethereum run? Is it the yen, the Turkish lira, the S&P, the cycles of the moon? The various posts over time have been helpful, and I wanted to know where Weston and Peter discussed their own approaches and brainstorm. I'm reading that wrong. Anyway, what are your thoughts on Bitcoin? What's driving kind of crypto markets right now? What are you thinking?
What a timely question. So in a few minutes on the Real Vision YouTube channel, I will have a video publishing about this new driver of Bitcoin. So just wait a few more minutes. What I will say, though, however, is that this is something that is not new to the Real Vision Exchange members. It's Monex Group. And so people who know what I'm talking about know what I'm talking about. That's basically BEC. And those who don't, just watch the video. But keep a look at Monex Group, which is a Japanese stock, 8698, and watch that stock gap up 20%, limit up for the last 2 days consecutively. And if you look at the intraday price action, you'll see what is moving Bitcoin spot during Japan cash equity hours.
Very interesting. Samuel, any broad thoughts on crypto? Last time we talked, we were talking about crypto being a possible, safe haven for capital flight from China. What are you thinking about it now?
I still think it's a very useful tool for capital flight. And that's not just China. I mean, that's basically anywhere. But I think now you're having a much, broader acceptance of DeFi generally, which I think is quietly one of the significant drivers, particularly of ETH moving forward, that we will have tokenized securities continue to become a larger and larger part of the trading model, and the 24-hour ability to trade Tesla, for instance, is extremely interesting and extremely powerful, and something that if I were, and I think I said this last time, if I were Fidelity or Vanguard, I would be very, very scared of the continued rise of DeFi. So I think as we continue to see applications prove prove themselves not just in, you know, as use cases, but as true daily actual use cases, that's a big deal, and that will continue to accelerate adoption moving forward.
Can I ask something about Ethereum too specifically? I tweeted this out recently, but so Ethereum, CME is going to be rolling out Ethereum micro futures on December 5th, I believe. And historically, if you look back, it's kind of funny because when CME rolls out Bitcoin,
the last top, right?
Yeah. So when they did the original Bitcoin futures, you know, the larger contracts, that was, you know, that was top. And then when they did micros, that was also top. But Ethereum is actually the other way around. Ethereum sees a breakout for futures. And what actually stopped the breakout from the Ethereum futures was the introduction of Bitcoin micros that came in. So I'm not necessarily bullish on, you know, Ethereum micros per se, but I think that that's just another step into getting a Ethereum futures based ETF, which is going to run up the futures market in order for, you know, these ETF providers and the APs that are involved to, you know, kind of accumulate. And you're going to get that same sort of October 40% up move that you saw in Bitcoin ahead of, you know, this Ethereum futures back ETF launch that will probably be coming shortly thereafter. So for that reason, I would be bullish. Yeah.
Cool. We got one more question. I think we covered a lot of the, we answered a lot of different questions, but there's one really interesting one from the exchange. And I actually want to direct this one to Samuel as a last kind of signing off question. Remain Calm asks, my family runs a small business in Florida. Most of our staff is hourly and we have watched wages rise from $10 to $13 to $15 since COVID to keep the team together. Should I expect to be paying $20 an hour soon in 2022 or in 2023? What do you think, Samuel?
Yes. I think that's it's $20 an hour, but you should also be able to raise price. I do think that if you have a business that has pricing power, you will have the ability to raise price without a significant issue, because it's not just you that will be raising price, you raising wages to $20 an hour. It's going to be everybody who needs an extra employee. So yes, if you want good employees, it's going to be more expensive tomorrow than it is today.
Very good. Weston, Samuel, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you all for watching. Thank you for your questions. Really appreciate it, everybody. Have a beautiful day, and we'll see you tomorrow.